Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and making his debut on this, our 100th show, Joey Barton, podcaster, radio star, resting footballer. We'll be exploring two familiar themes, leadership and management. So let's start with this week's North London derby. Will both Tottenham and Arsenal have new managers next season? What do you reckon, Johnny?
Well, it's a big question to start with, Mike. I mean, it's for different reasons that might be the case. Opposite reasons, really. You look at Tottenham, who, you know, will give everything, try everything to keep Pochettino, but are going to face a real difficulty in the summer with Real Madrid in a rebuilding phase and him pretty much top of their list. They might not be the only club looking at Pochettino, but they'll be the biggest and they'll have the best chance of getting him. So they face a challenge to keep hold of him, whereas Arsenal are in the situation of facing a challenge as to almost how to get rid of Wenger, if I can put it as bluntly as that. Because when you look at what happened last summer, they renewed his contract, I think mostly because Stan Kroenke had the final say and the owner played safe. Behind that, within the club, changes started to take place, led by the chief executive, who's preparing for a future beyond Wenger, which now puts Wenger's position in new territory, where he's not fully in control of the club. And they'll be at another crossroads, whether they go that step further and actually get rid of him or not. So for two very different reasons, both of those managers could go.
Mm. With Wenger, you know, we talk a lot about shelf life in football. What is the optimal time for a manager to be at a club? You know, you look at American football, a great coach like Bill Walsh would say, well, 10 years maximum, they stop listening to me. What about professional football? A lot less than that?
Well, I think we've seen this season, it can vary from four games to 4 weeks. I think, as a manager, I would presume it takes 3, 4, 5 transfer windows to mould the squad in your, you know, philosophy, whatever it is. Whether it's I always believe a team ultimately will reflect the manager's personality after a period of time, because, you know, you're seeing with like Sam Allardyce at Everton now, he's got players there that he clearly would never endorse, and he's got a process of trying to get some out and trying to get ones that he likes in, and then the league position doesn't allow him to get probably his number one target, so he has to compromise. So in the Premier League now, you just don't get that opportunity. I think, you know, the likes of Wenger, he's probably gone through the cycle, got his team, and he's probably at the point of staying at the party too long. I think if you look at the kind of dynastic managers or the dynastic coaches in other sports, whether it be the NFL or, say, I said Alex Ferguson at Man United, I think what Alex Ferguson did was obviously built multiple teams. But if you notice, they never changed the manager, but they would always change the first team coach. So whether it be Rennie Mulsteen, Archie Knox, Steve McLaren, Carlos Queiroz, you know, Brian Kidd, that would keep the fresh impetus in the group, because, you know, if somebody keeps talking to you all the time, eventually you'd probably drown out the sound.
Do players have a sixth sense for a manager's weakness?
I think human beings just have a sixth sense for each other's weakness. And obviously you go into an alpha male environment like that, where you've got a lot of type A personalities who are you know, fighting to survive the law of the jungle at times in terms of the next contract, or, you know, you're going from being the best thing in the world in one game, you know, 6 months later, you're the worst player in the world. You know, just look at like a Fernando Torres, for instance. So players are always fighting to survive. The ecosystem is very fragile, or so they believe it to be. And, you know, they're always testing each other. You know, you, whether it's the game on a Saturday, you're testing your direct opponent or, you know, your teammates. And if you don't, such is the nature of the beast that generally the minute you show weakness, it's either exploited and somebody's moved on, or it's exploited and you have to strengthen that weakness in order to survive.
Mm. And players are conscious of what they read in the press or here on the radio or TV. If you take Pochettino as an example, we've already talked about the assumption that Real Madrid will look at him in the summer. Yeah. So when they're looking at their contract, you know, an older Vareld, or, you know, maybe a Dele Alli who's thinking, well, actually, if he goes to Real Madrid, I might go there as well. That creates its own tension and its own dynamic, doesn't it?
It does. We've seen with Marco Silva at Watford what happens when players get the sense that the manager, the leader, isn't committed to the cause. The leader's got to define the cause. The leader's got to be the most committed to it. And that's a trick that Pochettino's got to pull off, because he's also got to come across to his players as ambitious. He's got to come across to them as a guy that wants to go to the very top of his profession, because that'll bring them with him. But he's also got to give them the sense that he thinks he can do that at Tottenham, whether that's realistic or not. And I mean, Joe will know from a player's point of view how it comes across. But, you know, we're talking about Ferguson, who probably is an outlier, because he was able to project the sense that every year the mission was just as important as it was on day one. Very few managers are able to do that. I think with the Super Bowl last night, I don't know much about American football, but I sort of zeroed in on the comment of Bill Belichick, who, you know, has already won 5 Super Bowls, and was sort of taking responsibility for the defeat and berating himself, saying, I didn't make the right plays, I didn't do that. After the career he's had, what that's done is set the mission for next season already. He's already said to his players there, you know, I'm hurting really badly about this, and this is down to me. And they'll know that he's going to put them right. I think that's fascinating management for someone of his status. But that's the kind of thing Ferguson did year after year. And it's so difficult in any walk of life, I think, for a leader to keep being as intense as he was on day one, or show people he's as intense.
Do players lose respect for the manager who blames everyone but himself?
Yeah. You know, I think that it's like anything, isn't it? If you've got a friend who blames everything but himself, eventually you just start thinking, what's he on about? You know, at some point you have to take responsibility for it. And I do understand, look, there's more facets to the game than the manager selecting the team and the players not performing. I think as a group, as a club, you win together, you lose together. And I think at times that can include the supporters who go to the game. You know, I think they're capable of creating a positive or negative atmosphere in which the team can play. I mean, some people are labelling it at West Ham after the weekend that the fans are vicious towards the board, and that's creating a kind of negative cycle. On the Pochettino one, you know, as well as he's done, let's not, you know, mess about here. He hasn't won anything. So to go from Tottenham Hotspur, which I think is a fantastic football club with a great emerging young side, about to move to a new stadium. For me, they've just gone past Arsenal in terms of, you know, I think they will finish in the top four and get in the Champions League, although it's going to be tight this year. Whereas Arsenal, I don't see any hope again for not getting in the Champions League unless they win the Europa League. They've got a really good young manager. Looks like the training ground, they spent a load of money on it not long ago. I think it's a club on the up. Flip side of that is Zidane looks like he's going to lose his position at Real Madrid. You know, you've got to think Pochettino. He's a young emerging manager in managerial circles. He's not won anything. You know, they've only done well in the Champions League in the groups this stages. He's got a tough tie against Juventus coming up, which is not going to be straightforward. For him to think, you know, I'm going to be able to walk in the Real Madrid dressing room in the summer and have superstars who've won multiple European cups, the side, you know, in world football that dominates that Champions League, and you've got a guy who's not won a trophy as a manager, I think it's going to be difficult. I think a more realistic option for him would be whoever wins the Real Madrid PSG game that's coming up. Someone's going to lose the job, Unai Emery or Zidane. I think if it's Zidane that keeps his job, I think Emery could well be replaced by Pochettino, who is a former PSG player. I think that would be a natural progression for him. And then if he wins stuff there, which he should do at Paris Saint-Germain because they're so dominant, then on to maybe a Real Madrid.
Moisey faced that at United, didn't he, walking in without having won medals to a dressing room full of medals. But, I mean, do players look at that? Did you look at what somebody's actually won before?
Well, it's the old phrase, isn't it? Showers your medals.
Yeah.
But I read a really interesting thing about that in terms of the coaching mindset. So it was... You see Mourinho kind of win and goes in, and it initially was Martin Johnson. So Martin Johnson goes from World Cup winner, captain, iconic figure of the National Rugby Union side. He gets the England coach's job without any real coaching background experience. And they talk about the sliding scale. So constantly as a player, as a person, there's a scale of credibility from 0 to 100 that everybody's always on. So obviously the more someone tells you the truth, the more they improve on the scale. So Arsene Wenger coming from Grand Passé, for instance, turns up at Arsenal. Nobody really knows much about him outside of Japan and France. He maybe starts at 20 on the scale. Results, player recruitment, the way he communicates, all of a sudden builds a title winning side. He's up to 80, up to 90, up to 100 on this scale. Now, as time's going on, we'd have to say he's probably sliding down the scale of credibility. Whereas a Martin Johnson probably goes in because of his achievements as a player and a person and a captain, 60, 70, 80, every training session, every press. I think, you know, not being unfair to Mark, because I think he's a legend of playing, but as a coach, I think he regressed. You've seen it with Gary Neville. As a player, goes in as a coach, thinks he's, because of the smoke that's maybe blowing round him, he thinks I can go to a foreign country and be a success. Scale probably goes in every session, can't communicate, can't speak the language, results go against you. For you know, he's crashed and burned and he's back here with his bags and no more visits to Valencia.
So we live in a harsher world, not just football, in the big picture. And probably the media reflects that. Now, if you take what you're talking about, Arsene Wenger, if an Arsene Wenger came from Japan now, as opposed to in 1996, it would be, who is this bloke? What, you know, this is a joke appointment. It's a lot harsher, and people make assumptions without any knowledge now, don't they?
They do. I think it's harsher, but I think you can also win quicker, which we saw with Marco Silva. So although he started with huge questions about him, it didn't take him long, I guess, to use the noise, you know, talking about the media angle, the whatever it is, to his advantage. Very quickly, he was a messiah. So I think managers...
Messiah who got him relegated, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. And a messiah who...
It shows how quickly you can hijack the system.
You can.
You know how to work.
That's exactly what it's like, playing the system. Marco Silva knew what to do. He projected himself brilliantly, you know, cut the right figure in interviews. And I think players, modern players, are actually influenced by the media probably more than a previous generation.
You can't escape it, John. It's so encompassing of the game, and everyone's on phones. There's so much content now that it's difficult to escape it.
Yeah. I mean, Eric Black said something from a coach's point of view. You know, Eric Black still does the first team coaching at Southampton, and he said younger players in particular have got more independent ideas about how football should be played. For example, they've grown up with the debates about, I don't know, the Guardiola style via the Mourinho style, the Barcelona way and all that sort of stuff. They've got a lot more opinions. So when you're just working them on the training ground, they've got opinions about what you should be doing with them and how they should be playing within, you know, this sort of lexicon of football systems and so on, which again is being influenced by all the stuff that's out there. I think it must make leadership even more difficult than it's ever been.
I think that's why you need a manager to be a benign dictator, really. I don't think democracy works within football clubs. I really, really don't. You look at Pochettino, I think that's what he is. Everybody knows he's the leader, and leadership roles and responsibilities cascade down from it. And I think in football, when you get a situation, which I think feels happening at Chelsea now, where nobody knows who the leader is anymore. Conte goes in first season, everybody knows who the leader is, and everything comes down from that. Now, Who's signing players?
We're reaching the end game with Chelsea and Conte, aren't we? When he says basically, back me or sack me, you know what they're going to do.
Yeah, well, yeah, and there's a game going on there, because if he keeps talking about how long he's got left on his contract, which is another big marker that he wants to get paid in full, doesn't he? He's not going to walk away, and we know there's options for him to go back to Italy. But from a playing point of view, they'd be looking at those games taking place. And this has happened at Chelsea before. It's happened with Mourinho and Villas Boas. And when the manager ends up at odds with the hierarchy. And I think that's why Chelsea are unique among the big clubs in that the performance can just absolutely crash, but then be resurrected again when the next guy comes in. I don't think the other leading clubs are quite as volatile, but it comes from that sense that comes around every 18 months in the cycle that actually the coach is no longer in charge, and the players see that.
See, but I think that comes from the owner having varied amounts of interest.
Really?
So I think when he appoints a new manager, he kind of hands over, I trust you, I've made a big play at you, you run the club. And I think as time goes on, he maybe gets bored, he gets idle thumbs, and he starts to take some control back and communicate maybe with players, whether it's renegotiations. And then all of a sudden, he starts to undermine his own manager. Maybe it's a cultural thing. And then I think that's why it implodes, whether it be Mourinho, Ancelotti, Gus Hiddink, you know, Scolari, and whoever's been there. You can't say that they're all short-term managers, because at other clubs they've had longer tenures than Chelsea. So I do think it's... And if you're a multi-billionaire Russian oligarch, you know, you have probably a certain style of running your company.
Well, you're not used to saying please or thank you, are you, really?
A bit more of a benign dictatorship, or probably a dictatorship.
But you see, with Chelsea, you know, you always get the sense that it's an intensely political club with an intensely political dressing room. It's anarchy when you get players going round the back door, which, by reputation, is what goes on at clubs like that. Have you been in those situations before when there's been... You've been probably one of the ones going round the back door, haven't you?
No, I'd go straight through the front door and the windows if I had to. It does confuse things, because you get a manager who's trying to set a disciplinary tone, and I've played for a few clubs where that's happened, one in particular, which I won't name, but everyone will know. The manager would be doing one thing, the owner would be doing another thing, so he'd be negotiating with the player on, I've heard it, he's negotiating with the player on a contract, agrees with the player that that's the limit it's going to, and then the owner comes in and says, actually, no, we can do this, and all of a sudden, the manager's undermined now. So you need strong leadership. It's like anything, it's common sense. You need it in your house, whether it's with your kids, in terms of if the kids ask you, can Dad have a chocolate bar, and your missus says no, and you say yeah, then all of a sudden there's a conflict, and now the kids are confused because they don't know who. You've got to kind of have a message that runs throughout to have that discipline, because I think everybody needs a structure and a discipline. And in football, where there's multi-million pound mega egos and agents coming in and you're being bombarded by everything, if the leader it doesn't sit at the top and everything cascades down from that, then I think it's a huge issue. And I think, but on the flip side of that, everyone would say, well, Wenger is the leader at Arsenal, but and they still have similar problems, but we'd have to say, well, is he? Because I think Arsenal's problems have been aligned with the struggles in the boardroom for control. I think when that's come in, I think that's what's muddied the waters.
Well, I think it's a club that's lost a clearly defined sense of mission. What is the mission there? You know, it was a club that went from the mission being the absolute best in the country, if not in Europe, to being a club that was happy to be in the top four.
And make money.
Make money. And that's happened around the time of the stadium. I think that's when the values started getting diluted. So you can't... Maybe it's not even Wenger's fault that the mission's been diluted. But for me, the worst thing that's happened to Arsenal recently, just from a leadership point of view, was Alex Iwobi. And not a lot's been made of that. But I could not believe that in that situation where Iwobi is supposedly out at 2:30 in the morning, on the day before a game, not 2 or 3 days before, but the day before a game, and he's a young player who's still trying to prove himself, that he just stays in the team, and he's still in the team.
Are you saying he should have took him out first game back at the Emirates and 50 lashes or stone him?
Where's the leadership there, though?
He's made a mistake, hasn't he? Do you mean? I'm with you, and I've seen the Arsenal kind of legend saying, you know, that wouldn't have happened. That's probably one of the things that wouldn't have happened. You'd have been disciplined and left out the team and made an example of, really. But the modern era, you know, Wenger's man management, played with lads who were senior lieutenants in his dressing room who've gone back, and they said what the side that was built title winners, if you look at that Arsenal side, warriors, leaders of men in that group. And he's gone to now where he doesn't like shouting, he doesn't like people raising the voice in the dressing room. So he's gone for a different style. And I think Arsene's got himself in a position where there's no self-editing, so nobody going, hang on, what are you doing? I think he's got himself in a position now where he's like, well, I'm going to do this in spite of everybody else. I'm going to do it my way, and I'm not going to stop till I do it my way just to prove everybody wrong. But ultimately, he's getting further and further away from what is probably... I think if he wins the league, he'd quite happily go out on it, but he's getting further away from that. And now he's at the issue, I think, is he's going to stay too long and probably start... He started already to ruin his legacy. I think the longer he stays, I think the further he could tarnish it. Because he's revolutionary when he came in. He was in he's been an enormous figure in the game here. Enormous figure.
Almost like a philosophical opposite of one of his great sparring partners, Jose Mourinho. Now, we're in a week where we're going to remember the 60th anniversary of the Munich air disaster. A real concentration on the traditions that Manchester United stood for, or do they still stand for? Is Mourinho cognizant enough of the great traditions of Manchester United to be accepted as a really good Manchester United manager?
It's a big philosophical question, but instinctively, it's the answer that you know got told you on day one, which is no. Because he does not stand for the same football values that Manchester United have always stood for. You know, you go back to the Busby quote about Old Trafford being in the centre of that kind of docking area for the Salford docks, and the guys that were going to watch them were dockyard workers, and that Busby quote.
He'd logged off at 1 o'clock. And
give them fantasy on a Saturday afternoon. Give these guys something at the end of their working week to embrace. Now that is the opposite to the Jose Mourinho approach to football, which is utilitarian and it's about results. So I just think that from day one there's been a conflict there. That's not Jose Mourinho's fault, by the way. That he is what he is. He's won so much by being who he is, and they hired him. But I think the club hierarchy are the ones that are guilty of misunderstanding what Manchester United are about. And I think if Mourinho was playing more Manchester United football, he'd get a lot more slack than he gets. But when results don't go right, because results is really all he's offering them, then there's a crisis almost every single time.
It does not when you look out your window and you see blue side of Manchester.
Exactly.
And they're getting results and playing with a panache and a style.
Yeah.
I can't believe Man United never did everything they possibly could to take Guardiola when he knew he was going to leave Bayern Munich, and they knew that Fergie had left. They should have done, because they'd steal a march on everybody. Surely they have. And I play for City, but Man United's an incredible institution of football. They would have the pull and power. Maybe it's Guardiola's ultimate challenge to make Manchester City or try and, you know, close that gap as a football club. But you've got
knock
to look
them off their perch, as someone might say.
Knock them off the perch. But you would also, on the flip side of that, the Busby era and entertaining and Man United's ethos, and maybe the drop off in the 70s and 80s until the Fergie era of success. Whereas now I go to Old Trafford and don't see many dock workers from Salford in there. I don't. You know, so people who are turning up now at Manchester City are second, third generation who are expecting to win, who have grown up with Man United in the 90s and the 2000s, winning trophies, and are now turning up saying, we're Man United, we want to win. They don't even know anything about Man United's tradition. So they got the court in between catering for that. I mean, Mourinho's come out, I think it's this morning, and said, you know, about the fans in the stadium and the noise. Well, if you watch Man United away, and I think a lot of the away support is
brilliant,
probably more the dock working generation of Salford, the hardcore. They sing and they're as good a fans as anyone in the country. You go to Old Trafford and you get the old Praud and Sarney brigade all coming in for a day visit. It's not the same noise.
Yeah. Would you have liked to have played for Mourinho?
I've had correspondence with Mourinho. I like Mourinho. I think he knows his strengths and his weaknesses. I think he can be, when he's good, he can be engaging, I think very entertaining character. When he gets Jose against the world, I think he can be difficult, but there's not all of us. You know, when you're in a good mood, you're great to get on with and great to socialise with, and when you're in a bad mood, people wouldn't just lock you in the shed and not speak to you, switch the lights off on you. So, you know, you can't knock his trophies. He knows how to win. And I agree with John. You know, I think the fact that Pep is winning and doing it, well, is about to win, doing it with such style, he's making everybody look inferior.
I think one of his challenges is, and this is where the club's kind of got this mixed identity now, they're still signing him fantasy players. They're still trying to sign those magic players.
Yeah, it's Galacticos.
Yeah, and he's trying to put them into a Mourinho team. If he was able to just buy Mourinho-style players, I think they'd be more effective. I think United would be closer to City. But he's trying to bring his approach a little bit closer to the identity of the club he's working for.
Well, what did Man United used to do? They do what Bayern are now doing in the Bundesliga. Yeah. They see what everyone else is doing, and they just buy the best players from the league and weaken the opposition and then strengthen their side. Fergie oversees it. But I think Man United have gone kind of Real Madrid.
Very much so.
The old Man United was width, youth, pace, adventure.
Yeah.
Not getting too much of that, are you?
Yeah, but the old Man United, you know, you look back to the sides they've built, but the game's changed, Mike, you know what I mean? You didn't have a sovereign wealth fund buying your local rivals and saying, tell you what, we'll spend 700 million in the next four windows. And, you know, you didn't have that. You know, you were pretty much, if you had your fan base, you know, they would give you the revenue and then you had to win trophies to get further exposure, further revenue. You didn't have these billionaires buying clubs and going out. So Man United are now in a situation where I actually don't think Sanchez is a top quality player, no doubt about it. Any team in the world would probably benefit from having him in and around the team. But I actually don't think he's really for that team right now. Yeah. But they just couldn't afford anybody else to get him. So they're like, well, if we've fell behind City and we've probably fell behind, you know, Real Madrid and, you know, the big European superpowers since Fergie left, we're trying to rebuild. So if somebody comes on the market like that, we've got to take him, because if we don't get him and they get him, City get Sanchez, we're even further behind. So they've got to, they're in an arms race now where, because of the financial power of the club, they've got to be seen as hoovering up superstars. Yeah. It was Real Madrid in with Vigo, with Zidane, and to be honest, it worked for them.
Yeah.
So I can see it where, if you keep outspending people, eventually you'll get success.
But poor old Pep can't even fill his substitute. What did you make of that?
I know. Well, yeah, this is the one thing, this whole last couple of weeks, I think it's the one thing that's tarnishing Pep's season a little bit. Tarnishing is maybe a big word, but it has just dampened it just a bit. His behaviour from the point of losing Leroy Sané to an injury, fairly short-term injury, you know, 6 weeks or whatever, immediately then wants Mahrez for whatever price, 60 million, doesn't get him, and then makes that little statement on, you know, by only naming six substitutes. And I was listening to Steven Gerrard about this, and I totally agree with him that what he's doing with that kind of self-indulgent statement is he is denying a young footballer the chance to be on the bench for that game and the chance to enhance his own career and experience. It's probably not going to matter to the game and the result, that extra sub, but it's going to matter to one individual.
There's symbolism in it, isn't there?
Yeah, that's dreadful.
You know,
do you think that's a bit?
No, I've heard everybody, Gary Neville, Steven Gerrard, everybody's outrage at it. And I listened to Pep's rationale of it. Mm-hmm. Look, there's no doubt there's more subtle undertones to why he didn't do it. But you can only bring three subs on a Saturday. So realistically, you don't need seven substitutes. It's not compulsory. You have to
take the young player in, but give him a taste. Like, what did you feel like when you first sat on a first team bench?
Well, I wanted to sit there on merit, thinking I had a chance to get on the pitch. I didn't want to sit there as a token gesture and think I've been brought here to make the numbers up, because that's a different mindset. If you're going to do that, you might as well get one of the fans out the stadium, out the stand, who've paid for a ticket and enhance his experience.
That City youth team's won everything, haven't they? They can't be...
He did say they've got a game on the Friday. I don't want to take one of them out of the team environment when I've got no intention of playing them and take him away from his game. So I can understand the rationale of it. I think everybody's looking for a stick maybe to beat Pep on. And I like to take sometimes a bit more perspective and sometimes the opposing view from everybody, which it's easy to say, you should have put someone on the bench. Listen, if there's somebody there on merit and he's considering bringing them on, or he thinks it's going to enhance his development, I think he's done it with young Phil Foden. I don't think he's averse to doing it.
Does Pep make that decision if it hadn't come off the back of the transfer window?
Well, Well, it's hypothetical, isn't it? We don't know.
A coincidence.
Well, what's he protesting against? Not having enough money to spend? He spent £732 million.
He can't
protest against not spending money, John. Yeah. He spent a lot of it.
Well, when we sort of wheeled in sticks and we've got Pep in the vicinity, what about the Mahrez situation? There you've got a player at Leicester who we're told is depressed, certainly isn't turning out for training, or hasn't turned out for training last week. You know, I was at Leicester on Saturday and there was a real sense of outrage is too much, but people were affronted by the fact that City came in thinking, well, okay, we're the biggest club. Well, hang on a second, these guys were champions two seasons ago. Mm. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, I mean, Mahrez is stretching what is a really generous sort of amount of love for him. He's starting to stretch it among the fan base. And the idea that he's projecting is that he's being kept unfairly prisoner against his will because this brilliant club's come in for him. Hasn't he done enough to earn the move? I sort of get that in professional terms. But Manchester City came in on deadline day for him. They didn't come in at the start of the transfer window. They came in on deadline day. And they also bid about 50% less than Leicester's market value for him. Now, Leicester might be wrong in their valuation of him, of course, but they've set a valuation. It's like when you put your house on the market. And there's no room for negotiation from a Leicester point of view. City come in on deadline day and it's kind of, we're going to give you 60% of what you think he's worth and take it or leave it. I don't see that as a huge, terrible injustice for Riyad Mahrez. I see that as entirely logical from Leicester's point of view that they rejected it and he's their best player and the owners love him. I also, to be fair, see it as logical from City's point of view that they make a cheeky bid to see what they can get. So Mahrez has got grounds for wanting to improve himself, but the specifics of how that deadline day happened means I don't think there's been any injustice done to him. So he's got to get on with it. And if he continues on strike, and I'm not sure if he would be leading it, because that's not the type of person he is. Tevez went on strike, different character, same agent, by the way. So that's the point I'm trying to make here. If Mahrez goes on that...
He's newly his agent, isn't he?
Exactly.
They started working together recently.
And the strike's
same agent as Coutinho, so is that where the valuations come?
Yeah.
And also the thing that concerns me is nobody bids now. Nobody makes a bid for a player unless they know the player. Everyone's tapped up. Every player's tapped up, whether we like it or not. Whether it's not directly or it's indirectly, there's always feelers put out, would he be interested in coming? So that's probably been...
And personal terms are usually sorted as well.
Personal, that's why they happen so fast. Personal terms are already done before you even get in negotiation. And I think that conversation's gone, well, we're going to bid up to X.
Yeah.
And they've gone, well, OK, that should be enough to make the deal happen based on market value. It hasn't been enough. And that's when the toys have come out the pram as a last... throw the dice to make that deal happen. Yeah. And when it hasn't, he's backed into a corner. You know, Riyad Mahrez, can he... You know, from his point of view, he's won the league for Leicester, won PFA Player of the Year. I mean, how far... Leicester are going to finish in the middle of the table this year. They've replaced the manager a couple of times since. You know, he signed a contract. You know, he's probably been waiting for a big club, Champions League club. He's had a taste of it to come back and take him. So you can understand from his point of view wanting to go and play for City. The argument would be, how many games are going to play for City when everyone's fit? Is he going to go and be a space filler or playing in the League Cup? Well, it could happen to him, because I don't think he's good enough to start every single week in that City side, not in the vein of form Sane and Sterling, where I don't see where he fits in. But for his, I think, ego, he needed to take the next career step. Should they have sold them? Well, I agree with Jonathan. Leicester have got a, you know, based on Coutinho going for 140 million or Neymar, everybody's setting their players. Well, if Coutinho's worth that, Mahrez has won the league a couple of years ago. He's won PFA, but like Coutinho never done that. So we should be copping at least 100 million for him. So I can understand Leicester going, well, if you don't give us fair market value, we're not selling them. But I can also understand Mahrez wanting to go. So I don't think that's the end of that. Because what happens if players down tools now? Players get out. Players hold all the power, not the clubs anymore. Because Mahrez will just say, fine, I'm not playing. I won't play till the end of the summer. You've seen with multiple transfers over the year. You know, Leicester at some point, like Sanchez at Arsenal is the prime example. Wenger's now saying I should have sold him. and got 50 million yeah. for him, and now I've got, you know, I should have sold him because this in the dressing room, all the political issues it causes in the dressing room when you get a bad egg.
Yeah.
I would have sold him.
What about the application of power, Joe? You know, we talk about one of your former clubs, Newcastle. You've got there an owner who's been, is reviled. Doesn't look like he's going to sell. Rafa Benitez is almost a source of hope for the fan base. Do you think Rafa should have been more aggressive, more militant in coming out against Ashley during the window?
It's tough. He's an employee, isn't he? So it's tough. Mm. You know, he'd be in breach of his contract. Obviously, he's got a family to feed. He doesn't want to get the sack. And you know, nobody wants to get the sack. He also probably feels a responsibility to the club to be that, you know, strong hand at the helm while there's a bit of choppy waters. So it's a tough one. I thought that deal was going to happen. I still think it will happen. You know, usually there's an appetite to do a negotiation. You know, I think there is an appetite to sell. I think Ashley looks like he's had enough. You know, I think he wants maybe slightly too much in the negotiation. And it looks like there's an appetite to buy the club. You know, the fans, I think, need it. I think they deserve it. You know, they still sell out the stadium every week. I think Rafa would be well within his right to say, enough's enough and I'm out of here. And I can see that happening if the deal isn't concluded by the summer. I think he'll stay to the summer, keep them up or not, because they're in a dogfight down there. If they stay up, I think he might go, do you know what, and Ashley hasn't sold the club, I think he'll go, do you know what, I can't do this any longer.
I think that has influenced it, the dogfight, because if he had made a huge fuss in the transfer window, if he'd really pushed, Newcastle's league position is so precarious that he can't risk anything affecting the team at this point in time, because a few bad weeks could do for them. So I think that has been part of the calculation.
Mm. But yeah, we talked right at the start of the show, Joe, about your podcasting. You got this podcast called The Edge.
It's unbelievable.
Is it? No. Not as good as this one.
It's best one. I've heard this is the second best.
It starts with you and Sean Dyche. Give us an idea of the defining characteristics of Dyche.
Well, it's tough to distill down like that, because obviously you spend a lot of time working with someone, and you know, for me, as I say, he's got to be up there, and I think this season's proven just his qualities as a manager. Certainly in the modern game, he's come from. If you'd have said 10 years ago, our top two managers, British managers, are going to be Chris Hughton, Sean Dyche, and Eddie Howe, people would have gone, well, what's happened to all the internationals with big level experience? But this is the situation we're in. And, you know, I think when you look at the Burnley group, and I know they get a good result against Man City and, you know, the Sterling miss and a little bit of luck goes the way. But when you look at the league position over the course of the season, you look at the budget, something has to be going on below the surface. And I think the podcast touches on that, and it kind of shows a depth to the way he thinks, to the way he thinks a group should be formulated. Then you look at the influences on his career, you know, whether it was Brian Clough when he's a young boy at Forest, John Duncan, who he talks about in there, and the managers up and down the pyramid of English football that have influenced them in a positive and negative way. I think this is the crux of our coaching structure now, that we've got to do something to make sure we get these generations of coaches. We don't have an Antonio Conte, for instance, coming in for a year, gone, leaving no legacy. We don't have, as we've seen with the English national team, Fabio Capello coming in for a couple of years and then gone. I think we've got to be very, very careful to protect what is already an endangered species, which is the British coaches in this game, because ultimately when the money and everything else goes, these grassroots coaches and these coaches that they then can aspire to up the pyramid, the likes of a Sean Dyche, the likes of Eddie Howe. I mean, we've already lost Gary Neville because he's had his fingers burnt in one job. We've got lots of people who will sit on this couch as pundits who go, it's too volatile, it's not for me. Top players, top football minds, I would say, but they don't want to do it because of the volatility of the nature of that industry at this moment. So, you know, what is Dyche? I think the best quote I pull from, and there's many, many, because obviously it just soaks into your brain after constantly getting them told, you know, over a period. But he said something in the podcast, which was his minimum, when I was asking what he looks for in a person to come in the club or a team player, says they have to have the minimum requirements being maximum effort. He says after that, yeah, I can work with anything else. Wow. But he says I need them to give me whatever they've got. And, you know, I can understand people making mistakes. He said I can work with that. But what I can't work with is somebody not giving me everything they've got.
So, I mean, it's a brilliant podcast. I've listened to it. And one thing there you go, Joe.
Didn't have to say that. I wasn't here.
But the thing that it starts for, it starts with you talking to Sean about meeting him at his house, which immediately tells you something about who he is, letting you into his home.
And is that because I'm from
Not you personally, letting a player into his home. And, you know, you're no longer his player, but the other thing that comes through is that you still have a relationship with him. So there's a relationship there in the moment you meet him, and there's a relationship that has outlasted your working relationship with him.
Well, he talks about that. He talks about, you know, helping people become better people, which will help them become better players, you know, showing the players that you actually care about them. And I think when you look back at over all the good managers, so, you know, what the cycle we're talking about, Fergie, even Arsene Wenger, you know, Brian Clough, Don Revie, wherever you go to, anyone who's had success, you think back to people who've maybe been your editors in newspapers, the ones who've cared about you, the ones that you go above and beyond for.
Not too many of those about, mate.
Well, I don't know that industry.
That's old school.
People who cared about you tend to get more out of you.
And you speak to old Man United players, and it's the personal relationship with Fergie that they remember most of all.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I spoke to Paul McGuinness, a very, very good youth coach, whose dad, Wolf, took over from Wolf Busby. Matt Busby. And he made the point about connectivity and almost like following in the footsteps that, and this is where maybe Michael Carrick going back into the coaching structure, that's a throwback to the Fergie days, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's the passing of the baton, the passing down of values, which was something that was... Fergie always wanted to make it even more. He was never satisfied. He wanted to have ex-players in the boardroom. You know, he was always looking for ways to reinforce that legacy. It started when somebody came in the dressing room and the senior pros got a hold of them. You know, I spoke to Rio Ferdinand about the schooling of Ronaldo, which he said a lot of the schooling was actually done by, you know, Paul Scholes and Ryan Giggs and him and Gary Neville, and before it even got to Fergie. So that's the sort of environment. It's those personal relationships passing down the line.
Culture's you.
And I think that's what that Burnley dressing room has got.
And it's taken a bit to build. You know, when the podcast, we explore that when he first walks in, because you'd always inherit someone else's group. Mm. And that's why managers, ultimately, if they're good, they need the time to develop that culture, because it's not something that you can... Some managers I've worked for try to hijack it, or there's a shortcut, which usually will be the wheeling and dealing of players, because you think, well, actually, if I bring a player in from a good culture or a good club, he would instill some of those values here, and if I get enough of them, we'd recreate that culture. And sometimes that can be a
fix. It takes time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But ultimately... Yeah. The basics done very well over a sustained period. Now, if you've got the leader changing all the time, that's why you can't. That's why Watford, I'm like, how are they staying up? Because they literally change manager all the time. But somehow, I think the Pozzo family owning it is what helps them negate it a little bit, because they sign the players by the look of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just hire and fire the coach. He's an interchangeable part.
Yeah. We'll end with a few questions from the listeners and the viewers. Start with you, Joe. It's your club. Jonathan Allen asks, will Sam Allardyce see out his 18-month contract at Everton? Indeed, should he?
I think he should, because I think if you appoint a manager and he's prepared to take that job at that time when Everton were in my dire straits and were going to no doubt be in a relegation battle for the rest of the season, I think the fact that Sam's put his hand up and said, I'll take the job, should allow him to see the contract out. I don't think it will. I don't think they ever fancied him. So, you know, I don't think they ever wanted him, because we know the Marco Silva story. I think he was maybe target number one, and I think Sam was probably a little bit down the wish list. They end up at Sam. He goes in, turns him round. But the Evertonians expect a style of football. You know, as most football fans do now, what that is, I don't know, but when they look at Man City, when they look across the city to Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, they expect a vibrant attacking brand of football, the school of science, the Alan Ball, you know, Alex Young, Colin Harvey, Howard Kendall, all that kind of, you know, ethos that's at Everton. And I think they harp back to those days. Now, Sam, no matter what we say, is not going to really float that boat. It's just not. It's not the way he goes about it. Sam prides himself on being defensively solid and structured and keeping clean sheets. I don't think that's happening. You've got the offers of a new stadium in the background. I think that's going to confuse matters. And my argument was, rationally, if I wanted to buy a house and I was in the market for buying a new house, I've just had to get out my old house because it was falling to the ground. There's a Dutch windmill that was the roof was caving in on, and I want to buy a new house. And the house I want to buy, which was the nice Portuguese villa, had a tenant and they didn't want to sell no matter what I offered them. So I end up going for a nice two up, two down in Bolton, Dudley. And that's what I'm happy with. That's the lot. And then all of a sudden the Portuguese villa comes back on the market and I've got the financial means to buy it. Then surely you'd move out of the two up, two down. But in football, you know, you might have to cop a bit of money on the way out for the agent fees and the compensation. But if that's your dream house and that's what 4 months ago you were aspiring to live in for the next 4 or 5 years, as soon as it becomes available, surely you've got to take it.
All right, well, let's talk about...
You don't like a good analogy, Mike?
Yeah, it's not bad. Well, I'm now going to extend the analogy. We're going to talk about the modern mansion that is Liverpool.
Yes.
Or Anfield, anyway, with that new stand. It's from Asim Raseeb. Does Jonathan think losing Coutinho and not buying a replacement will cost Liverpool a top four place this season?
Well, it hasn't enhanced their chances of a top four place, has it? I mean, I thought from the start it was a mistake in football terms to do it. I mean, we've talked about how difficult it is to keep a player when he wants to go. So, okay, that does that. But selling your best player and not replacing him at a precarious point of the season when you're also a team that's so dependent on, or was so dependent on, that particular player for a particular thing, you know, set pieces. He was a unique skill set in that Liverpool midfield in terms of being able to keep the ball and hold on to it a little bit. If you're going to sell him, you have to replace him. For me, if you really value the rest of that season, it's a mistake. But I think it's Jurgen Klopp's gamble. I know that some Liverpool fans want to sort of pin the blame on FSG. I can understand that. They love Klopp. They don't want him to be blamed for anything, really. Instinctively, they want it to be someone else's fault. But I think it's Klopp's decision. He's a long-term thinker, so he's doing it with the idea of the group in mind. He doesn't want Coutinho there if he doesn't want to be there. And he wants to save his money and spend in the summer. That's fine, but it doesn't help the rest of this season.
See, I think when Barca came in the summer, I think Coutinho was promised, look, we'll let you go. Yep. But give us time to replace you. Give us till January or to the summer to replace you. And I think when they came knocking the second time, if you remember when Coutinho, the second mutants of the bid from Barcelona were up, Liverpool had Adam Lallana coming back to fitness. Yep. They had Mane, who was sitting on the bench and not happy about it. And I think Liverpool thought, do you know what? He was struggling to get the front four in. Firmino, Coutinho, Salah, who was on fire, Mane. I think he thought there'd be more rotation between Salah and Mane.
Yeah.
The Ox had come in and they were thinking, where do we get him in the side? And I think Lallana coming back to fitness made Liverpool think, do you know what? We can sell him, we might replace him, but if not, we've got enough to keep the momentum going. And as that's proven, you can't lose, you know, no disrespect to any of them, probably barring Salah, none of them are at the same level to replace Phil Coutinho.
Final question, because time's run away with us. It's from Anne-Marie Batson. My question is, West Ham, a club in crisis?
It's an institution in crisis, isn't it? After the Tony Henry sacking, fallout, debacle, and that's highlighted what an uncomfortable position those fans are in terms of their owners and who they think's running the club. There's been another transfer window. They haven't spent the money they wanted. There's the problems over the stadium. There's just that unhappiness there among West Ham supporters at the direction their club's being led in. And as I say, the Tony Henry affair just heightens this sense that we're being run by a bunch of people we don't like. So that is a crisis when the fans are on one side and the people in charge of the club are on the other, and the players are trying to make it work on the pitch, that is a crisis, and it's certainly not going to help West Ham's relegation.
Do you get a feel for a club like that?
I actually feel sorry for the fans in a way, because I think there's clear opposition to going into rented accommodation. Said this morning on the radio, you know, there's a big duplex apartment available and it's cheap rent, and they've gone in there and they haven't got the furniture.
He's off again, by the way.
Yeah. They haven't, mate. They haven't got the furniture to do
Collins
it.
In the corner and the
people, they don't want to be in there. Do you know what I mean? So it looks quite bare. The fans have got no unity with it. They know it's... There's speculation this morning that there's a clause in the contract. I don't know how true it is that if they go in, there's not going to be allowed to be championship football at the stadium. So if they go down, which could happen, I don't think it will, but it could, then they're going to have to find a new ground, because one of the clauses in the Leighton Orient bid was they were knocked back because they didn't want lower tier football and they only got it because it was Premier League. So I think it's a mess, and they didn't want the David Moyes appointment, which I think has ultimately turned out to be a decent appointment. It's done well. Stabilised it on the pitch a little bit, although they've had a bad result the weekend. But they're talking about getting rid of the... I don't think they're happy with Karen Brady and the owners. I think when she refers to them as customers, I think that's very, very insulting to die-in-the-wool West Ham fans who've been with that football club for a long period of time. And it doesn't really have an identity, Mike. It doesn't... When you talk about West Ham now, and they're out at Stratford, and it's a lovely stadium, it's a lovely part of the world, but isn't West Ham, it isn't symbolic of that football club. And I think going to this stadium the last couple of years, I think they've almost lost their identity a little bit on and off the pitch.
Well, the club's in a mess from top to bottom. For once, that's not the fault of the manager. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.